Welcome to Voices of NCAJ. We're talking to members of the North Carolina Advocates for Justice about what it means to be a trial lawyer, what it takes to be great at the practice of law, and how being a part of NCAJ enriches their lives and careers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome, everyone, to Voices of NCAJ, the podcast for the North Carolina Advocates for Justice. I am Amber Nimix, your host and director of external affairs for NCAJ. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's episode sponsor, Advocate Capital. Advocate is passionate about helping plaintiffs' attorneys get better results for clients, mainly through their AdvoTrack case expense funding service. It allows firms to track case expenses and recover borrowing costs, which makes the net cost of borrowing zero on cases they win. Learn more at advocatecapital.com. My guest today is Sam McGee, NCAJ Legal Affairs Counsel and of counsel for Wilder Pantazis Law Group in Charlotte. Sam, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So most NCAJ members who are paying attention and read their trial briefs and their community view religiously, as they should, know that your role as NCAJ Legal Affairs Counsel involves managing NCAJ's amicus briefs program and organizing the moot courts. But I'd like to start today's conversation by talking about what some might not know about, and that is that you represent NCAJ member interests at the State Bar Ethics Committee. Tell me about how this works and about your recent win for NCAJ criminal defense practitioners.
Sure. Yeah, in some ways, the State Bar Ethics Committee makes that easy on us, right? They provide good updates on their website and through their publication of everything that's going on with the State Bar, both in terms of proposed ethics opinions and proposed rules changes. So what we do at Legal Affairs, we make sure to monitor those, and I send a report every quarter to the members of the Legal Affairs Committee. The reason that's important is because the Legal Affairs Committee has people on it from really about every NCAJ practice area. And so that was a proposed opinion that came up in the criminal context, and it had to do with the question of whether prosecutors can condition plea offers on a criminal defendant not seeking discovery. So in other words, you're not going to get the information that they have against you. You don't really get discovery in district court. And so they were saying, hey, can we just tell them you got to take this deal, but you're never going to know what the evidence against you was. When we sent this out to the Legal Affairs Committee, several of our criminal defense practitioners said, hey, wait a minute, this is potentially a red flag. I also had some other folks, NCAJ criminal defense lawyers, reach out to me directly, even that weren't on the Legal Affairs Committee. And the concern really was that the opinion said, yes, you can do this, but it didn't talk about other obligations that we know prosecutors have, like to not pursue a case without a sufficient factual basis and to provide exculpatory evidence, the stuff that can help the criminal defendant. They have to provide that to you. And the possibility of an opinion that didn't talk about those obligations, but said, yes, you can condition plea offers in this way, created a potential problem for criminal district court practitioners across the state. We formed a subcommittee to look at the issue. Lauren Newton was the Legal Affairs VP at the time, so obviously she and I were on it. But we also had some great criminal law folks. We had Chris Haney, Amos Tindall, Andy Banzoff, Ann Blyman, Elliot Abrams, so a really strong team. And we wrote a revision of that ethics opinion to make sure that these other ethical obligations of prosecutors weren't being overlooked. Ultimately, because of concerns we expressed and some other groups, the opinion got kicked back to subcommittee, and those who commented were invited to come to the committee meeting. So Andy Banzoff and I went to that meeting on behalf of NCAJ, and ultimately the subcommittee recommended maybe we don't issue an opinion on this. And so it went back to the ethics committee and they decided to withdraw the opinion altogether, which a lot of our concerned criminal defense lawyers thought was a great result.
So do you think that this opinion would have gone forward if NCAJ hadn't been in the room to make the noise that you guys were able to make?
I think that's entirely possible. And I will add that there were some other groups that weighed in as well. And I think the sort of collective power of multiple groups weighing in with concerns really did make a difference. And I also want to point out that this is just one example of several that I could point you to where we are actively doing work in the criminal defense arena. Sometimes there's a temptation to think, well, NCAJ is focused on the personal injury cases, the med mal cases. But in the 3 years that I've been legal affairs counsel, I really wanted it to be a priority to make sure we had good representation from our criminal defense practitioners on the legal affairs committee and that we were making sure that those issues were addressed. So right now, for example, we have 4 amicus briefs in the drafting process, 2 of which are in criminal cases. We have another brief that we've written that we're waiting for a ruling from the state Supreme Court in a criminal defense case. And then, of course, this ethics opinion issue. So just want folks to know that we are really active in that practice area as well.
And it can be a challenge to sort of highlight some of the work that the Legal Affairs Committee does, because some of it is about helping things not get done, right?
Yeah. And I think Chris Nichols would probably tell you the same thing about legislative work. You know, it's easy to celebrate when we get a bill passed, but sometimes when we help kill one in committee, you know, that doesn't always get out there. It's kind of the same way in legal affairs. You know, you read the tea leaves, you look at opinions, and there's some issues that are going up. And when there are important issues going up, we probably want to be involved. There are other issues where maybe it's something that our appellate courts need to address, but for whatever reason, this might not be the case or this might not be the time. And so a lot of times we're talking to folks about whether they should appeal a certain case. In fact, one of the things generally that I really think we've expanded over the last 3 years is the degree of informal assistance we give to people who have really important cases and primarily to NCAJ members that come to us and say, hey, will you look at this brief for me? Or I have kind of an odd issue of appellate procedure. Will you discuss it with me? Or, you know, should we go forward in this appeal or not? And again, those aren't things that necessarily turn into some victory that you can tout, but it's important work that we're doing in the background. So I encourage folks all the time, if you've got something going on with an appeal or you just want another set of eyes to look over your brief, you can shoot me an email at sam@ncaj.com and we're happy to take a look.
You know, that's something that we have in community view and we repeat it in trial briefs all the time, but it's really a message that I don't think we could say too often, is that you guys are, and gals, the Legal Affairs Committee is there for anybody who really has a question. Like if you don't feel 100% sure, or if you just, like you said, need another pair of eyes, if we could hire a skywriter and put it out on the beach and tell people, I mean, I think that, because I think a lot of people probably like feel like, you know, they might have some trepidation about coming to legal affairs for help or, you know, with their briefs or especially with whether or not they need a moot court, right?
Right. When we think about moot courts specifically, you know, last fiscal year, we did 19 moot courts. That's a lot of moot courts. And that was anywhere from the North Carolina Court of Appeals to the Fourth Circuit. And I remember that was a span of a few weeks where we did some workers' comp moot courts for Stuart Poisson and Vernon Sumwalt. And then a few days later, we had a Fourth Circuit moot court for Elliot Abrams. And then we did a North Carolina Court of Appeals moot court for Noah Abrams. And then another for David Stradley. So we were doing a bunch of these. We did one for Andy Banzoff. For a lot of, you know, lawyers that you would know, lawyers that everybody in CAJ is aware of and they know they do great work. We also do a lot of moot courts for folks who it might be the first appellate argument that they've ever done. And so there's kind of a double temptation there. You might think, well, this is just for the young kids, or you might think this is just for the big dogs. And neither one of those things are true. The last case I argued in the North Carolina Supreme Court, NCAJ did a moot court for me. You know, so it's definitely the kind of thing where we offer this to everybody. Just over the last couple of days, I was looking at a brief for Lauren Newton and Matthew Berthold, right? Excellent lawyers that have written a lot of briefs before, but they wanted an extra set of eyes on them. So it's a message I do want to get out. It doesn't matter if you've been practicing for 1 year or for 40 years, something like a moot court could be a good service to you, or the informal assistance that we offer on appellate issues. Kind of related to that, as I would say, involvement in what legal affairs is doing is also not just something for people who've been around 30 years, right? if you're a younger lawyer and you're thinking you'd like to get involved, if you reach out to me and say, hey, I would be interested in doing a moot court or helping out in legal affairs in some way, shape, or form, I might not have something for you that day, but the odds are there's going to be an opportunity. So I just really don't want people to hesitate, whether it's to be involved or to ask for assistance.
Right. Because that can turn into being an assistant writer on an amicus brief can, I would imagine that's a, getting that experience can really benefit you going forward.
I can't even remember what year it was, but it was probably over 15 years ago. Burton Craig reached out to me and asked if I'd be interested in being a junior writer of an amicus brief in a medical malpractice issue. And the senior writer was going to be Adam Stein, you know, who's had tremendous success through every level of the courts. You know, later he and I were at 10 Fulton together, not in the same office, but I had never met the guy at that point in time. And so to be involved in doing a brief with him was a big thing for me at that point in my career. And so it's funny how time plays tricks on you. The next thing you know, I'm the one pairing people together to write briefs, or maybe I'm the senior guy on a brief. But yeah, there's always ways that I can plug people in ways that are beneficial to the organization and honestly, probably be beneficial to a young lawyer as well.
Right. And so it wound up paying off in some big amicus brief wins, like the one that you just had with Town of Apex v. Rubin, right? That came out, that was in August, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Just came out from the Supreme Court of North Carolina. Unanimous opinion. The Chief Justice did write a concurring opinion, but no dissents. And again, this is kind of what I'm talking about, right? Yes, we do a lot of things in the personal injury and medical malpractice arena. We've got a couple of med mal amicus briefs cooking right now. But here's a win eminent domain field, right? And, you know, if the government is going to try to take your property, they should have to do it right. And the Town of Apex didn't do it right. They wanted to condemn part of Ms. Rubin's property for a sewer line. And the courts ruled at all levels that they were not doing this for a public purpose. They were doing it for a private purpose to benefit a private developer. And therefore, they did not have the right of eminent domain in the case. So what did the Town of Apex do? They did it anyway. And then they went to court and said, well, you know, we have taken your property by inverse condemnation, and we're just going to give you a little bit of money for your trouble. And everything about the way they were doing this was wrong. And so we got involved and did an amicus brief in the case. And the Supreme Court really got this one right. And they did a few really important things. Number one, as they said, inverse condemnation is not a claim that the government brings against an individual. That's a claim that an individual brings against the government if the government takes your land but didn't follow the proper process. So they dismissed that odd twist that the government was trying on inverse condemnation. They also agreed with Ms. Rubin that, hey, this is her property, not yours. You don't have to right to be there. And your continued presence there is a trespass. And then they referred it back to the trial court to determine what the proper remedy for that trespass was, with a couple of really important pieces of direction. One being, the court has the right to tell the Town of Apex to leave. They can issue a mandatory injunction on that. Number two is, if they decide just to make them pay money, it's not going to be enough to make them pay the money that they would have had to pay had they done the condemnation properly in the first place. But instead, they have to think about how property values have changed over the 10 years of this litigation and how much money the town saved by going over Ms. Rubin's property instead of going around. So if it's only money, she's going to have to be compensated in a more meaningful way than, like I said, if the town had done it right in the first place. So this was it was a great opinion. It was written by Justice Riggs, and the amicus brief was written by Shiloh Dom and Suzanne Todd, who've been part of the leadership of the eminent domain section. And so, yeah, it's good. Sometimes those victories can be hard to come by, but I think this was a really important one.
Great. That's awesome. So what else can you fly the flag over recently, or I guess since you've been doing legal affairs counsel for 3 years now?
Yeah, just a shade over 3 years.
Uh-huh. I know you came on about the same time that this new sort of configuration of the state Supreme Court did, right?
That is correct.
You got this lineup when you first got here, and you were cautiously optimistic. Would you say that was your...
I would say I had recently had a nice victory in the state Supreme Court in its old configuration in an important class action case for North Carolina retirees. But yeah, obviously things are more challenging at some times than other times. But like you say, it doesn't mean that we can't win some important victories, and it doesn't mean that we can't get some important things done, even, you know, in the informal way. You know, one drum that I bang from time to time is the Safe Child Act cases, you know, which were the cases where our legislature unanimously extended the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse. And they did this because those victims that come forward, and many never come forward, but the average age of disclosure for a victim of childhood sexual abuse is 52 years old. But under North Carolina law, in some cases that I was involved in years ago, you know, if you don't bring that lawsuit by the time you're 21, you lose the right forever. So a full 31 years before the average person comes forward. So that statute of limitations was extended, but there also was a 2-year window for anybody whose statute had previously lapsed. And so a lot of claims were filed, and that case was decided in favor of plaintiffs. That 2-year window was upheld from a challenge under the North Carolina Constitution. NCAJ didn't write an amicus brief in that case. Actually, I personally filed amicus briefs for an organization called Child USA in those cases. But we did moot courts for all three of the cases that were being argued. One was argued by Bobby Jenkins, one by David Stradley, one by me. And the cases in which the constitutional issue was reached were decided in our favor. And so that was a place where, again, we weren't signed on to a brief, but, you know, we had important involvement throughout the process, and we handled moot courts in those cases.
NCAJ recognized the work that Bobby Jenkins and Lisa Lanier did.
There was a group of us that were working on those cases that were sharing notes and talking and honing arguments for an extended period of time. And Bobby was a huge part of that. And they was very deserving of that award for the work they did and the Lanier firm in seeing the value in those cases and being willing to go the distance with them. But, you know, we had a lot of folks from NCAJ that were involved in that. Obviously, David Stradley and Lito Copley had one of the cases, and I was working on them. But we had a lot of other folks, too, that were in the background and helping out on that. It was an important effort. And for me, it really meant something, too. And the Supreme Court ruled against me on some cases based on res judicata, but they left us open a window to potentially have that original judgment set aside under Rule 60. And so I actually got cases resolved for my clients who I've represented all the way back to the time when I was junior writer on that brief with Adam Stein. I think I was representing one of those guys all the way back then. In fact, his settlement's finally being dispersed, and it's there's nothing more rewarding than being able to do that for somebody who's had to wait for justice too long.
Wow, that's a long time. I interviewed Lisa for trial briefs, you know, when we gave her the award this summer. She talked about the early years of her practice doing sexual exploitation cases and how there were few people to talk to back then when she had to find mostly folks out of state. And so to have a growing number of people in state and within NCAJ to be able to trade expertise and information on those kind of cases as a number of them, the body of work around it grew. I'm sure that was a real, in terms of the resources that a group like NCAJ can help provide to its members, that's something that we don't, you know, falls loosely under the category of networking and expertise, but, you know, that's really so much more.
I remember really feeling that way about nursing home work years ago. I had been originally practicing in North Carolina. I spent a little bit of time in Tennessee and was doing nursing home work there, and I came back to North Carolina. And when I first met, and I was still a relatively young lawyer at the time, when I first met the folks from the nursing home litigation group at NCAJ, you know, and I'm talking about Karma Henson and Steve Guggenheim, Elizabeth Todd, James Rohn, you know, some people, Philip Miller, that have turned out to be, you know, great friends of mine over the years. It's like I had been doing this work in Tennessee and I came back to my home state and started doing this work here. And I was asked to talk about arbitration at a nursing home litigation group, CLE. And it's the first time I met some of those guys in person. I'm like, oh, my people. And those are important relationships that we've had over the years, you know, through official NCAJ events and just by the fact that, I mean, even today, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if I got an email today from somebody in the, you know, the group of folks in the state that all know each other through NCAJ that do that work saying, hey, I've got a case against such and such. Have y'all had a case against them recently? Or how about this, you know, usual suspect defense expert that's showed back up, you know, and so those are really important resources.
And, you know, we also get to show them off in you know, not just in private conversations, but also in with our CLE programs. And you have, you're busy planning one of those on ethics coming up in February, right?
Yes. When I took the job as legal affairs counsel, a few days later, I got a note from Veronica McCoy saying, I don't know if you know this, but you're in charge of the ethics CLE. So I do that. Legal affairs oversees that CLE every year, and it's a great way to get ethics credits. Of course, it's in February for a reason. So we've done that a few years, and we've had some really good topics. We're actively working on this year's CLE right now. We're going to definitely be talking about artificial intelligence. Judge Emmon did a segment on that last year, and a lot of folks have said, hey, let's talk about that some more because it's a constantly developing field and there's new things emerging all the time. I'm actually going to take that segment on and hope to have a special guest with me who probably knows more about AI ethics than any of us or all of us combined. And we're working on another segment that could be a lot of fun. That'll involve clips from popular TV shows and movies and that raise strange ethical concerns. So anyway, we're working on a couple other topics. But hey, anybody who is interested in speaking at such a CLE or has a topic they want to hear about at such a CLE, every year we end up talking about topics that come from members who say, I'd like to hear about this. So again, sam@ncaj.com for anybody who wants to talk about that. But the CLE will be February the 25th, and it's usually a really good one.
Yeah, never miss a Sam McGee CLE. So if someone needs assistance from legal affairs, what's the process for that?
So for amicus briefs, the easiest thing to do is to go to the NCAJ website, and there's an actual online form to request our assistance. That goes directly to my inbox, and then we initiate our review process. For something like moot court or for informal assistance, the best thing for folks to do is just to email me at sam@ncaj.com. Or anytime, whether it's about a potential brief or anything else, you can always just reach out to me and ask a question. Interestingly, though, some of the most important things we've done in the last year or so begun with a request, but actually started with us trying to be a little bit more proactive and finding opportunities to get involved in meaningful cases. For example, there was the ethics opinion we talked about. And that one, that arose out of our review of the quarterly ethics updates from the state bar. And the next thing you know, we formed a subcommittee and we're getting actively involved in the review of that opinion. In another situation, we had a criminal lawyer reach out asking us a question just for some informal assistance. And I already had that subcommittee formed about the ethics opinion. I said, hey guys, can you take a look at this? And that lawyer actually ended up consulting some with Andy Banzoff, and then he ended up getting co-counseled into the case, and then they asked us to write a brief. So that one began with informal assistance. We have a brief in another criminal defense case that we're writing right now that arose out of our appellate case review subcommittee. So we have a subcommittee of legal affairs that reviews all the appellate cases when they come out, and one of our members of that subcommittee, Chris Haney, reached out to Stuart Poisson and me and said, hey guys, this is a really important case. I know this lawyer. Can we talk to her? And we ended up having a conversation with that lawyer, and she said, yeah, we'd love to have amicus support. So sometimes it begins with that formal process, right? And then other times it happens more organically because we're out there being proactive.
So the moral of the story is ask for help, reach out. Well, Sam, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
I really appreciate it.
Sam McGee is legal affairs counsel for NCAJ. If you are involved in or are aware of an appeal that affects NCAJ members or their clients, or if you have ideas for an ethics topic for the CLE, or if you just want to chat with Sam about anything related to legal affairs, you can do so by emailing him at sam@ncaj.com. Be on the lookout for more information about the annual Ethics CLE on February 25th, and check out our full calendar of CLE and events at ncaj.com/events. Before we go, I'd like to thank our Circle of Leadership program sponsors. They are Abrams & Abrams, Henson First, the Law Offices of James Scott Farron, the Law Offices of John McCabe, Whitley Law Firm, Brown Moore & Associates, Edwards Kirby, Johnson & Groninger, DeMeo Law Offices, the Law Offices of Wallace & Graham, Horton & Mendez Injury Attorneys, Kuntz & Smith, the Law Offices of Jason E. Taylor, Sumwalt Group Workers' Comp and Trial Lawyers, and Orndorff Law Firm. These firms are supporting NCAJ's mission as founding members of the Circle of Leadership at the Gemstone level. Find out how your firm can join the Circle of Leadership at ncaj.com/circle. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Voices of NCAJ. For more information on the North Carolina Advocates for Justice and how to join or support NCAJ, please visit our website at www.ncaj.com.